Hi, welcome to Scriptlock, where we talk about storytelling in video games. I'm Nick Folkman.
And I'm Max Folkman. Today's episode has Kim Belair and Harrison G. Pink joining us. Kim is a scriptwriter at Ubisoft, the co-author of the novel Pure Steel, and the co-host of the weekly podcast, The Sexiest Podcast. Harrison is a game designer, having worked at Telltale on seasons 1 and 2 of The Walking Dead, along with The Walking Dead 400 Days, and also co-created Tales from the Borderlands. Most recently, he was a world designer at Hangar 13 on Mafia 3. Thanks for joining us today, you two.
My pleasure.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
So we'll start with Kim. How did you get into the industry?
Actually, it was kind of a weird path that I took. I've always written, and I've always been a writer in various forms, but I actually studied marketing, and I was working in branding and doing a lot of copywriting, which turns out actually did pay off, like, in terms of what is required of me in video games. But I did that for a long time, did a lot of branding, a lot of social media, and I started at Ubisoft when I was just found by a colleague on LinkedIn.
Wow, that actually does work.
Yeah, I was shocked as well, because I certainly am not someone who maintains like that side. Like, I'm very bad at LinkedIn, which I like to think everyone is.
Yeah.
Yes.
But yeah, so I got found there, came in marketing as a community developer, which is kind of like someone who does branding for social media. So Not quite a community manager. We're just above that. So we create interesting content that the fans might want to see. And I started on Watch Dogs, then Far Cry 4. And kind of a lot of the work that I was doing overlapped with writing and creating fiction. Until at one point I was asked if I'd be interested in joining a writing team.
It was just that easy of a transition?
Yeah, because the reason I was, I guess, free enough to take this job was that I had been working with a co-writer who also now works for Ubisoft, and she and I had done the book that you mentioned, Pure Steel.
Mm-hmm. Oh, cool.
And so I had kind of, in 2013, it was off to the publisher, and I was kind of open to whatever was next. So ended up coming over to work as a community developer, and then, I had kind of a portfolio already, even though I hadn't done game writing yet.
Right.
And so I made that transition in 2015.
Has your branding and marketing background, like, helped your writing work, too?
I would say yes, in two ways. In terms of branding and marketing, it kind of helps me keep the audience in mind and the kind of the beats and the emotions that I want to hit, and kind of makes me keep an eye on what's big and what is important right now. And then just for the copywriting angle of it, like, having to write, you know, 50 variations of one line.
Yeah.
I feel like having learned to, you know, talk to an agency about or talk to a client about, okay, here's 50 variations of your slogan. I think that skill kind of crosses over.
And you mentioned that, like, you've been writing for a long time. Like, how did you start writing, and when did you start writing?
In high school, I started by self-publishing some things when I was, like, way back there. They're not good, necessarily. I won't name them. Some of them can be found, but I won't talk about them. But I've always been interested in, like, long-form fiction. And
so these are novels that you published?
Novels, mostly short stories and smaller pieces. And one of the things that's always interested me is, I guess, engaging content and creating experiences. So if, like, telling something in an unusual way, which again will translate to video games, like the book that we did, Pure Steel, it's all told in ephemera from the turn of the century. So we would write fake newspaper articles, fake letters, fake correspondence, fake tickets, and tell a story through that. So you kind of have to guide yourself through it while the characters guide you through the story.
And what's your writing process like now? Or has it changed since when you started?
I think that I'm a little... I think I have more visibility. I mean, when you're young, I think what you do is you sit down and you go, okay, I'm just going to see where this goes.
Yeah.
And I think that's cool to do if you can, but what at least video games have been really helpful in is going, okay, here are the beats that I know I have to hit. Here are the big choices that I'd like the person to make. Here are the ways that I want them to engage with the world. And it makes me kind of have a higher level and a little bit more insight into where I'm going versus where I'm starting at.
Do you feel like you know where you're going more often these days than when you first started out?
Oh yeah, I didn't. I have from when I was in high school, I have an 800 page story that was like a super ridiculous, like high fantasy thing that I would just kind of make up as I went.
That sounds really cool.
It was not. It was wildly uncool, but it's like notebooks upon notebooks that are still at my parents' house. And I think that was just learning to actually write versus learning to tell a story.
Mm. Yeah.
Because man, that it just goes wherever. Like I can see in the moments like, oh, I must have been like reading a lot of Tolkien at this point because I definitely drew inspiration. But then like three chapters later, I definitely played Legend of Zelda and decided on this.
There's still something cool in that where you're letting yourself just go freeform, like kind of stream of consciousness and see where your mind takes you instead of being more regimented.
Which I think, I mean, I don't know, you know, how a lot of people feel, but I don't know how you guys feel about this, but sometimes the difficulty of working as a writer, like, you know, all day and often after that is that now I kind of lack that. I'm always thinking about where it's going. I'm always thinking about where I want this to appear, who my audience is, what the player is going to do, what the reader is going to think. Whereas, you know, I used to wake up at 4:30 in the morning in high school and just go like, oh, I just want to write because I love this feeling of expression. And so that freedom is in many ways, I think, gone. And I think my work has improved as a result of it. But overall, like, I can't imagine having that feeling back.
Yeah, I wish, because ever since we started writing, it's like when we go see movies, we're analyzing the script as we're watching the movie for everything now. And it's cool to do that, but I wish I didn't, because now I'm not surprised as often. And same thing with games too.
Oh, definitely. But at the same time, I think it's what the fun part is kind of analyzing the smaller choices in the writing of things that I observe.
Yeah.
Like I saw Wonder Woman not too long ago, and there's this like one interaction that's kind of, it's not really a huge moment in the movie, but I keep going back to it and thinking about it because I think, man, that's a great little bit of writing that I might not otherwise have noticed if it weren't my job to elicit those same emotions in an audience that I'm writing for.
It is cool though, like being able to go to a movie now and just have a larger vocabulary to discuss movies, where like before I started working in sort of narrative design and working at Telltale, I just kind of enjoy them on a surface level, like in sort of average viewer. But after talking cinematography and like shot composition and intent of scene and like all that stuff, now I just feel like I can actually have an interesting conversation with fellow, you know, ex-Telltale employees, and we go see Baby Driver and we can have an interesting conversation about like a particular shot or a particular scene and like the intent behind it and like if it worked or didn't work or what we thought they were trying to sort of do with, you know, this character. And I totally agree with that, like feeling of now once you peek behind the curtain, you can't sort of undo that, and you just kind of can't go back to your ignorant ways. But I do appreciate at least getting the ability to discuss that stuff more, like more in depth than I used to be able to.
Yeah, and I did identify the feelings, I think, and the, I guess, the sense of the scene more than just going like, oh, that was really cool,
right?
And not really knowing why it made me feel a certain way.
Can either of you think of a recent like storytelling beat in a game that you appreciate now that you wouldn't have like when you first started out?
I would say like all of Night in the Woods.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I probably wouldn't have played that game at all before that. Yeah. I would have grown into that.
Like what about Night in the Woods specifically?
I think that, and even, you know, even now, I was still shocked as I played it that a game could just be about hanging out with your friends and feel completely rewarding and completely beautiful. And so many of those small moments remind me of conversation. I'm 31 years old now, and the main character, May, is 20. And so she's supposed to be stuck between that time of, like, I'm between a teenager and an adult. And I'm ready to exist on my own, and I want to do my own thing, but at the same time, I'm not ready for responsibility. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the feelings that I remember throughout my 20s, and even now, are expressed in such tiny moments of just two friends reconnecting after a long time, or someone questioning, are they a good person? Or someone wondering, like, why are we doing this? Or just a moment where she forgets that, you know, her, one of her close friends' mother actually passed away a couple of years ago. And it's these things that we experience in life that we would never otherwise think, like, oh, this could be in a game. And I think Night in the Woods really opened my eyes to that and to the possibility of just saying, listen, here are a bunch of social interactions, and how you manage them can be something beautiful on its own.
Is that going to affect your writing in the future now, do you think?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. That, I mean, even Life is Strange.
Yeah.
Has that same feeling. Like, you know, obviously she has supernatural powers and there's a huge cataclysm on its way. But what is really significant is just the little choices that you make and the way that you decide to treat people and the way that, say, that they decide to interact with you. And that's something I aspire to right now, at least in my own work, is to create a feeling like you're really getting somewhere with a person and you're getting somewhere with your own character and yourself, versus just, you know, making your way through levels to some inevitable conclusion.
I'd hope that's every, like, writer and designer's goal.
I hope. I mean, maybe, hopefully.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I think that, you know, Kim, you definitely nailed it. And for me, I think it was working on The Walking Dead, the first season of The Walking Dead, where that really sort of opened my eyes to the power of just getting to know somebody. And, you know, you have this sort of big bombastic sort of backing, like world backing of zombies and the sort of, you know, apocalypse theming. But, like, that's just the just sort of set dressing. And none of that is really important other than to push two or groups of people together in a high stress situation and just sort of, like, watch the fireworks. And I, like, it took working on that game and sort of consuming it from the inside to really understand the power of just a conversation between two characters being, like, fun, like, quote unquote fun in, like, the video game sense. And, you know, just not being afraid to just have a quiet moment where you just talk to someone and catch up with them, because you haven't talked to them in a couple of months between episodes, because it might have been a few months before an episode came out. So, like, hey, what have you been up to? Let's, like, catch up. Being a thing that, like, players sought out, like, they went out of their way to go talk to a character that to them they hadn't seen for months, instead of, like, doing the fun gamey solve the mystery, like, click on stuff and interact with the game stuff, which that, like, the plot things. And I think that was definitely the first time that I realized, like, oh, the plot is really just there to get the character stuff out, and it was a sort of revelation for me at the time. And I think it's definitely changed how I approach that sort of stuff going forward.
And exhausting all the dialogue options.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Harrison, how did you break in?
How did I break in? My story is much less, like, inspirational, because I just tried a lot and failed a lot until I didn't anymore.
I think that's more inspirational.
Yeah. I just did it a lot and it was bad at it for a long time. I went to the Savannah College of Art and Design for 3D animation, and I was taking an elective in level design, and back then it was all, like, Unreal ED and super, super easy, simple level designs, like, software. And I remember staying up to, like, 4 or 5 in the morning to create this, like, shooter level. And I was like, well, if I'm willing to just stay up this late to do this because I love it, I should just do it for the rest of my life, I guess. So I sort of changed my major. Like, I went and changed my major to interactive design, which was, like, their game development major. And it was a visual arts college, so I didn't learn, like, a lot of programming. I just learned a lot of, like, level design and character design and stuff. So when I graduated, I'm 32, so I graduated, like, right in 2008, which was, like, the entire collapse of the American economy. So there was, like, yeah. No jobs. It was like, congratulations, sorry. And so for a long time, I was just trying to find something to pay the bills. And so I started working at this, like, a company that was, it did, like, I resized, like, advertising banners for websites. Like, I was just a graphic designer just to pay the bills. And I got contacted, I think it might have been through LinkedIn also, from a guy in Atlanta. I was living in Atlanta at the time. And he was like,
hey, tool.
Yeah. I mean, it was question mark. So I was contacted, and this fellow was like, I see that you do Flash, which was, like, the premier, like, 2D game engine at the time. You're a Flash game developer and you're local. We need somebody to join our group. And I went and talked to him, and it was literally just, like, 3 guys in a garage, and I was going to be the game designer. And it was a company that did, it was called Thrust Interactive, and they did a lot of services, which means if like TBS or TNT or like CNN or whatever come, they want to like make a little game for their website to advertise their, you know, their sitcom or their car or whatever, they would hire a company to do that. And it would just sort of be done, you'd basically ghostwrite a video game. So I did that for a number of years. And so like the first couple of years on my like resume, I don't have anything because I couldn't take credit for anything. And then I did that for a while, and then around 2010, I went to GDC, the Game Developer Conference, and I just took a stack of resumes. And I gave a resume to every single company in the expo hall, even if I wasn't interested in working for them, like everyone, Zynga or WB or wherever. And I remember seeing Telltale's booth, and I said, oh man, Telltale, like I love adventure games, and they're kind of the only ones still doing adventure games. I've always been an adventure game fan and like making puzzles and all that stuff. So I went and gave them my resume. And the guy that was at the booth was working the booth, and I struck up a conversation, and we were talking about games that we liked, and I mentioned that I loved Myst, and in fact I had a Myst tattoo, and he was like, oh my god, like ah, like he was also a big Myst dork, and so I saw him take
showed his Myst tattoo.
Yeah. We just kind of like touched tattoos. No, I saw him take my resume out of a much larger stack and put it in a much smaller stack. During this conversation, wow. Must have been the rejection stack and been going to the, you know, the yes stack. And that sort of, you know, clock wiped to me working at Telltale and then working on Walking Dead, which is just a huge windfall. So a lot of it was just me trying for months and months and months to try and get a game design job, like sending resumes out to all the big companies, EA and Irrational and 2K Marin at the time, and like a ton of big companies, and just getting no bites, and just kind of doing the grunt work and working in graphic design and then working at a startup, just as the games guy making little miniature, you know, soccer games or whatever. And then just trying to like slowly inch my way towards like a quote unquote legitimate game design job. And here we are.
Do you think that game design degree helped you?
I think, so when people ask me this, like how would you want to get into the games industry? I don't think it's, you have to have one, but I do say, I do believe that the degree itself proves I can stick with something for 4 years. And yeah. Also it gave me access to technology and professors and like experience and a reason to do the work, and like a reason to build things. Whereas I might not otherwise be a self-starter and do that stuff. So like my experience at art college was extremely valuable to my ability to make a game and like do that stuff. I don't think the piece of paper was at all like a magic, like a golden ticket to get a job or anything like that. And I don't think it should be either.
And I know that at least one of your credits had writing on it. Do you have a writing background too?
I don't, like I never was like trained for it. I just, I always loved creative writing, and like I would always just write dumb stories. I also have like an 800 page story that will never see the light of day that I wrote in like high school. It's like some weird like conspiracy theory Deus Ex thing.
Let's publish them.
I bet I can find them somewhere. And they're just so embarrassingly bad because they're just, just like you were saying, Kim, like they're just filled with tropes and things I saw in a video game that I liked, and just like whole like story arcs just ripped out of other stories that I really liked.
Oh yeah, it was huge when I started playing Pokemon. Like
Oh totally. Characters that are just completely self-insert fantasy, like fan service characters for myself, you know, the cool handsome guy, you know, and all the ladies like, and all, it's just awful and embarrassing. But I always loved creative writing and I always loved reading. I don't think I'm like the world's best writer, but I've always really enjoyed it. And so when I went to Telltale, at the time, the designer was also the writer per episode, because up till that point, the games had been much smaller and the scripts had been much less complicated and less sort of branching and dense. And so it was actually working on my episode, Walking Dead episode 3, when they were like, this is too much for one person to do. We need to split this job out into a writer and a designer. So I wrote an entire version of Walking Dead episode 3 that sort of got revised over time, as they brought another writer on to sort of like focus on that, because I was so focused on like the actual like interactive design, like how does the player interact with the story, engage with the story, and make sure that like the dialogue options sort of match the things that the player might want to do. And then over time, over the years that I was at Telltale, that's kind of what the design department at that studio really focused on. So I sort of transitioned away from writing like actual dialogue and sort of transitioned into what, you know, we kind of traditionally call narrative design, which is, you know, as I said earlier, like we have the script and we work with the writers, but like, how do we allow the player's agency to exist in a world where you're just kind of writing a story and having characters say it.
So now what is your design process like?
Boy, it's weird. I'm a very messy designer. I just kind of throw some stuff together and just kind of experience it and play it and go, oh, this is terrible, but here's what I can do to like fix it by degrees. So I just iterate over and over and over again on a small piece of content. I definitely plan things out. Like when I was working on Mafia 3, a lot of times I would start, and this is all level design, visual stuff, but I would start with like a pencil sketch, and then I would work with the artists to sort of like do like basic steps and really plan it out. But once I was in there, I would just kind of get my hands really dirty and say, oh, well, you know, this is the thing we want to do. And I would bring the writer and say, what if we could do this kind of story beat in this, you know, place where this is a, you know, we're going to make the level work in such a way that there's downtime where you can actually have dialogue between the characters that isn't going to be interrupted by a gunfight or something. Because it's really important to have like a dialogue about what's going on with, you know, like, hey, listen, can we just like rap for a second about what's going on in the story? Making sure that the level sort of like gives you time and space and pacing for that kind of thing. So it's definitely a very dirty, messy, iterative process. There's never, I never like go in and just like precisely execute on an idea and boy, it's done. So it's just one of those things where I just churn on over and over again on the same piece of content.
Is it ever not messy? Like you ever get ones where it's like, oh, I executed perfectly the first time.
It's weird because I see things like very high level. I see a vision, whereas some designers might be really focused on the details. I sort of look at it from a couple steps away and say like, what is the goal of this entire piece of content? And like, what is the feeling? I'm very like feelings focused when I design, like what is the specific feeling I want the player to have or that we want the player to have in this, you know, piece of content, and how can we move all the levers, narrative and gameplay and, you know, visuals to really, really push the specific feeling. So it really starts like 1,000 miles up looking at like this piece of content from a really sort of holistic vision. So I can't say that I've ever gone in and be like, oh, I know exactly what this needs to be, because that's just not how my brain works. So it's always started like really, really far away. And then I just kind of like one step at a time closer and closer to it as it sort of gets closer to me.
Okay. And I have a question about feelings, but I'll say that for later.
Mm-hmm.
Kim.
Yes.
You wrote an article last year called Imagination versus Immersion that was great.
Thank you.
So I thought we'd discuss it a bit here by asking you, do you think modern game stories leave enough to the player's imagination these days?
So I'll give the gist of the article.
Yeah.
And it was the idea that back in the day when we were kind of limited in our resources, especially our visual resources, we required a greater investment in the game by way of imagination. So if you're playing something like Super Metroid, you don't get to experience exactly what Samus is seeing. Whereas, you know, in a later release like Metroid Prime or something that were made today, we are going to tell you exactly how every boss looks. We're going to show you exactly how every corridor appears. And we're going to show you what is scary about that. Whereas, and I don't know how you guys felt when you're playing, you know, those games back in the day, but I understood that what Samus was seeing was absolutely terrifying in certain parts, right? With Phantom and stuff, like those things are very weird. And similarly with like a game like Earthbound, some of that stuff, like I have no idea how we would necessarily render it in a more realistic sense. But at the time I understood when something would creep me out or when something would thrill me or when something was supposed to be beautiful. And I think that what has happened as a result is that we have switched over from playing like with these characters and kind of, you know, Samus was not necessarily us. We were playing as Samus, whereas now we're kind of expected to take on a lot more empathy for the characters that we have because we're seeing the same thing as them and we're experiencing the same world. So to answer your question, you asked about investment, was it?
If modern game stories leave enough to the player's imagination.
I would say that in many ways, at least in the AAA titles, we've kind of stopped asking for that trust. And we stopped asking people to imagine. We started showing them more. And so I think I would love to see a little bit more effort. And smaller games are doing this. Like, you know, Night in the Woods says, hey, everyone's an animal, but you're supposed to recognize them as all your friends that you know and like in your own life. And I think I'd like to see a bit more of it, because I don't know if we're heading in a direction where we're asking the player to dream with us anymore. It's just like, hey, come and play in this perfect world that we've created. It's very rigid. We know every corner of it. But yeah, I'd like to see people asked to believe a little bit more.
What about Dark Souls?
Oh, man. Well, so Dark Souls is an interesting case because Dark Souls, like, visually, it's everything, right? When you see Ornstein Smough, or however you... I've heard many pronunciations, like Ornstein and Smough, but I'm going to go with Ornstein on this one.
Sounds good.
Yeah, there's so much emotion and so much story and so much feeling that we have to experience ourselves that, yeah, it does give us a little bit more to envision, because we're seeing a kingdom at the end of its days.
Yeah.
When it was meant to be dead ages ago. And being able to see that and feel all this great sadness, even though no one's sitting around going, oh, I'm so sad, you feel it. I think that's a triumph. And one of the things I think you mentioned, Harrison, was those moments where you have to have downtime. And you have to not necessarily have to shoot everything because you want to experience the world and characters. And that's something I wish that we would see in a game like Dark Souls or even Bloodborne. I would love to like finish that game and get like a new game minus mode where I can like go in and instead of it being really hard, it's much easier so that I can kind of like take in a lot more of the scenery, start wondering why certain characters look this way and start, really investing myself in inhabiting that world mentally instead of just going, okay, everything's going to kill me.
It's interesting. I totally agree with that. And I don't know if you guys know, I'm JP LeBreton, but he built a like tourist mode for Doom. That I think it was Doom, maybe Doom 2. I could be wrong, but he's definitely like he's this guy who basically built a mode for I think Doom where you can just walk through and it just doesn't spawn any enemies, and you can just like walk through the levels and just enjoy them as a thing. And I'm pretty sure that's what inspired the like New Game Plus for Firewatch that comes with like.
Yes.
The like commentary. And so like there's definitely been a push for like, can we just have tourist modes that have no puzzles and no difficulty, and it's literally just like a quote-unquote walking simulator through these games, through these spaces, because you want to appreciate them as real spaces, but you're so like distracted and trying not to lose the game that you can't really appreciate them and like just wonder, as you said earlier, Kim, just like wonder about the spaces and the people that were there or are there and why things are the way they are. And there's all this beautiful world building that just gets lost under the weight of like, it's got to be a game all the time.
Exactly. I don't want to have to always read. I love reading the art books, but I'd love to be able to actually exist and immerse myself there. And it's an opportunity that we have that's huge. And going back to the Super Metroid example, like so many of the backgrounds in Super Metroid are just black. There's not much happening, but we understood what it was meant to feel like and the infinite quality of it. But now that we actually have it and we have all those images, we're not really allowed to explore them in any deep or meaningful way. It's just like, okay, go to the next room, almost get killed. Go to the next room, almost get killed. And even like I appreciate a game like Uncharted sometimes when I finished like the waves of bad guys, and I'm just walking around to see what this place is.
Go ahead, Harrison.
I was just going to quickly say like that was something that again I really appreciated in working at Telltale, where a lot of the game itself just takes place in the player's imagination, where you see Kenny will remember that pop up and you're like, oh shit. Like you have all this, the infinite web of like what this might mean, like as far as consequences go, just like appears in your head. And like the game probably has one or two of those, but in your mind, they were like, did that guy get shot because of like this weird butterfly effect of me not giving this kid food from last episode? Like you just don't know because there's enough uncertainty. And I worked on enough of those so-and-so remember that actually weren't tied to anything. They were just there to like give you an illusion of that. But it works so well that you only have to do it and pay off on it a couple of times for the player to just be like, oh my God, everything must be connected. And the amount of game that is free just comes free to Telltale because it just happens in the player's mind, and a lot of the like meaning just gets imprinted. There's that like, you know, that bias that goes, oh, well, they're clearly being nice to me because I made a bunch of choices earlier where that was the only script written. Like they were always going to say this certain thing to you, but you sort of like assume it was because of a bunch of other things you did. And that's just free. We get that for free. And that the fact that it's all just player imagination, Telltale over time got really good at capitalizing on that sort of gray could be, couldn't be space between the actual choices. And I think it's really, really smart and why those games have sort of continued to do well, because you get so much quote unquote free content by just letting the player imagine what there might be.
For sure. Oh, and you can use that in real life too. Like if someone does something wrong to you and you just lean forward and go, oh, I'll remember that.
Then you start doing that.
Yeah, it's huge.
Do you think the lack of room for imagination in a lot of today's games is because a lot of AAA developers don't trust the players enough?
Yes. I absolutely do.
Yeah.
I think that there's a lot of, whenever you get a lot of money involved and a lot of people involved and you're dealing with teams of hundreds of people to sell to millions of people, I think that that naturally diminishes the amount of trust that you feel you can have. There aren't a lot of, I mean, we talk about it a lot just in the industry in general of, you know, why are these bigger games, why are these AAA titles not taking any risks? And it's because they can't necessarily afford to, because a lot of people are depending on this hitting certain benchmarks. And yeah. One of the biggest risks I think you can ask is, hey, will you come with me on this journey? Will you take time out of not only, you know, your day, but out of your mental space and your mental processes? And will you join me on this? Will you experience this story with me? And I think that by and large, if you want to sell to the majority of people, it can't just be like, will you experience a story with me? It has to be, let me just tell you a story, because that's what you want to see. You want to be diverted right now.
Yeah.
And that's why I think, you know, the smaller games and the shorter games that don't need to hit this, okay, we need to have the player play 100 hours. If you say, I'm going to make an 8-hour experience that you can please join me on, I think that's a lot, is an easier gamble to make.
Do you think AAA studios would change if they saw another game be wildly successful that did not trust the player as much? Or would they, do you think it'll stay the same largely for the future?
I personally think right now. Because, I mean, it's about the magnitude, I think, of the game and, like, the scale and the audience. So it would have to be something absolutely massive. And even then, I think there are a lot of companies that would say, listen, until we see hugely diminished sales, we're going to stick to the script.
Yeah, it's all like fear of, it's like loss aversion, right? Like,
yeah.
I mean, Kim nailed it. It's that fear of, you know, we have like data points and like marketing numbers and, you know, surveys and all this data that says like people want this thing, so we're going to deliver this thing to them. So to break out of that and say, like, no, like we just decide what the market is. Like we are going to do something wild and crazy. I mean, it's not even just the people at the top of the studio. It's, you know, there are board members and people who don't really give a crap about the like quality of the video game. I mean, not the quality, but like the creative content of the video game, as long as it sort of like gives them the return that they invested for. And there's all these other like things that don't have anything to do with the creative part of making a video game that are like, we can either take a big risk or we can just do the safe, easy thing and make sure that we're hitting the numbers that we were, you know, somebody told us that were the correct numbers to hit. And I think a lot of that, and I think a lot of the point that Kim made where it's like, can we get players to buy into this 40-hour thing where the writing has to be stellar for 40 hours is a bigger ask than saying, here's an 8-hour thing. The writing, here's 8 hours of good writing. One's in an 8-hour game and one's in a 40-hour game. Like, one of those two is going to be way more enjoyable to play and worth spending your, you know, money on. So I think that and a lot of that is just the bigger game companies, at least from my perspective as a grunt on the ground, that because we have trained that into the player at this point, like, we're kind of culpable of saying, like, we've made so many sequels and so many remakes and so many reboots, that going too far, like going too wild, kind of scares consumers because they're not used to it anymore. Yeah. So to say like, oh, here's a wild new game where you do crazy stuff that literally you can't be like, it's like X, but with Y in it. Then you don't even know how to like sell that to the player, or the player doesn't even know how to like get excited about that. So the idea that the games industry has sort of like dug itself into this rut, and then game players have also dug themselves into a rut of what to expect and setting those expectations, is definitely a terrifying thing to sort of reach out of. And to reach the deeper the rut gets, the more expensive it is to reach back out of it. And so, yeah, I don't know what companies are going to be willing to take, you know, to take a big studio and divert 100 plus people to work on a game for 3 years and it just be a big question mark.
I think another problem of it is similar to Hollywood big budget filmmaking, where the people in charge of these projects are in some cases just regurgitating stuff they grew up with.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's something that you see a lot of the time when someone will present you with an idea that seems so outdated or it seems so backwards, and you go like, okay, where's this coming from? And you realize, yeah, it's just, they're going back to something that they wanted, except now it's 20 years later and it's old, but they don't even realize that yet.
Or even it's their favorite game when they were a kid. They just want to make a game like that.
Oh yeah.
To work on it.
And that's the other thing is that, you know, if you see something, if a game hits and it's very unusual, then all the big companies, they might like turn their eye to that. And then, you know, how long does it take to develop a game for something like this? Like the game that I'm working on right now, it's an unannounced title. I've been on it for 2 years already. So if I was going to say, okay, I want to emulate this big release, maybe what, 3 to 6 years later, by the time like 8 other games have done it better, we're finally coming out with our different one.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, if you have a success and you can turn that around in 1 to 3 years, maybe just do that. I don't think that's a good idea, but I think it's a profitable idea.
Hmm. So, wait, I have one last question related to imagination and all this. Do either of you think that Solidity was easier to accomplish back in the old days when they had less technology to work with because devs were forced to work with less and rely on the imagination more?
Yes.
I agree.
This is a point that I think I also talked about a little bit. Like, back in the day when we had like a poster for a video game where we showed, like, we read the manual and we saw these like super cool bosses that we were going to encounter. They were like drawn by concept artists. Yeah. And when we saw that thing in the game, we didn't go like, hold on a second, this is a bunch of pixels and looks bad. We went, yeah, this is exactly what I was promised. Whereas now, like, if you have a trailer at E3 and your game looks a little bit worse, or if this character looks a little bit less defined, everyone's like, well, this is deceit. And so now we're in pursuit of, I guess, fidelity rather than vision. And we don't have room anymore to make those experiences or to really be concept arty. We have to make it look like exactly what everyone's expecting. And that means that they don't need to use their imagination at all.
I think that also a lot of that comes back to not having faith in your audience to interpret an abstract either concept or visual or story in a big budget game, at least, right? Like, that's why I'm so happy so many indie games are coming out that it's like, F that, we're going to do a wild thing and you might not get the story. We're going to just David Lynch it, like, figure it out. And I think that's not only really brave, but just, like, exciting because they have faith in their audience that they'll either get it and they'll love it, or they won't get it and they'll just kind of move away from it. When they have the flexibility to do that, whereas if people walked away from, you know, a Call of Duty or something because it was too abstract or too subtle, then you know you've lost a lot of money. So yeah, I mean, I don't know. I'm definitely just rambling and agreeing with Kim that just we have had this fear of audience for so long where we are sort of letting them dictate. We have taught them something and then they sort of say, well, that's what I want. We're like, well, okay, I guess we have to give them that. And we forget that back in the day, so much of it was just left up to the imagination of the pixels that you have on screen and what you think it might be. Like, you're playing like Link to the Past or any of those games back in the day, like, you, there were so many things that could have been in that game that weren't, but they might have been. Like, I bet behind this tree is some secret, or I bet, you know, if you, someone on the schoolyard told me you could do X thing 3 times and like a cool thing would appear. Like,
oh,
there
I
was space
that.
For, and the internet kind of blew that up. Right. But like,
yeah,
and that's why I've loved Breath of the Wild so much, is just that, like, I've stayed away from the internet. I haven't read anything about it. You know, if I get stuck, I let it be the way it is. And that game has just really felt like old school Zelda games. that's a tangent, but the idea that you can just allow a player to interpret either a sprite or a story moment or just a weird, like Earthbound, right? Like a lot of the humor in that was just bizarre, just weird. And like, it is what it is. If you engage with it and appreciate it for what they're trying to do and kind of like it for how weird it is, great. If not, it's fine. There's a million other games that are hyper realistic and don't require imagination out there for you. But I think that over time, the bigger the budget, the more scared of anything that bucks a trend or anything that isn't impressive. I think impressive would be the word that I would use, that in a negative connotation of it has to just blow people's socks off all the time.
Oh yeah.
And like, I can only get so excited anymore. Like everyone was like losing their minds over like E3 trailers this year. And I was like, is there something wrong with me? Am I broken? Cause like, I don't get excited about like impressive things anymore. I get excited about like brave things or like rare, unusual things like Night in the Woods or like Firewatch or, you know, like a number of other things that are just like, we're not going to try and remake Zelda. We're going to try and tell a new interesting story that's never really been done before. And that's the kind of thing that like the subtlety sort of is found in those games now. And that's really exciting to me.
I was afraid after E3 that I didn't like video games.
Okay, I'm not the only one. Thank God.
No, I watched E3 and I had that, like, after a couple days of it, just thought, like, man, what am I doing? And it's just because, and I understand it, it's because if you have a lot of money, you can't afford faith. Like, you have
Boy,
to
Boy, that's
be,
grim. But true.
I mean, at a corporate level, not an individual level.
Yeah, yeah.
And
that's the
poll
for
this
episode.
That's And, yeah, it was this kind of sad feeling where I just wanted to see what was small and what was compelling instead of something that was big and really beautiful. Like, it could be beautiful, but it's this empty kind of beauty that you say, like, we had to make it this beautiful in order to have it appeal to you.
But E3 is kind of not the space for small and beautiful anymore.
Oh, it is not, no.
Yeah.
And I acknowledge that. It's one of those just those gut reactions that you have when you're watching it and you're in the industry and you think, oh, okay. What am I doing?
Yeah.
And also a note on Earthbound is that I would like to talk about Earthbound forever, but it's a great point that it's hard to describe what that game's about and you're either in or you're out.
Could Earthbound get made today by a big studio?
Oh, never.
Yeah, no way.
Because they would have to be like, okay, what is this world? Like Mr. Saturn, like the Saturn Valley characters, we get no explanation as to what those are. And at no point do any of the main characters react to what seems to be a town of aliens. Like, they just walk in and they go like, oh, so here's the guys who live here. You know, Mr. Saturn. They're all called that. They speak in a new font. And they seem to have a culture that has lasted at least the past couple of years. And they're just your allies. They have no, like, there's nothing there. Later on, it's like, oh, come meet me in Saturn Valley. The Mr. Saturns have helped me create this spaceship. And you just go like, all right, I'll be there.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah, and I love that.
It's what's interesting about that, and I totally agree. It's these days, I think we in the like larger game space are like have a real hard on for like plot and like the twist. There's always like the act two turn, and like every game has to have like a moment where you're like, oh man, that like story, that like the reveal blew my mind, and like
yeah.
There has to be a ton of world building. It all has to be like hang together and make sense. Again, back to that like realism, that sort of like fidelity that you mentioned earlier, Kim. And, like, we can't just have wacky weird shit that's just like, yep, it's just, we're never gonna explain it. It's just a weird thing. Like, deal with it. Because we've taught players, and then the players have love, and I get it, because a lot of them like really love that stuff. And I'm a lore dork. Like, I personally am. I love that stuff. But if a game came along and it's just like, hey, listen, it's Night of Woods and you're a cat, but also there's actual cats walking around, deal
yeah.
with it. It's just like, all right, like it's never explained. It's not a part of the world. It's just the way it is. And that's oddly brave to do these days, which is such a shame, because, yeah, everyone's got to have their like thick Bible, right? They're like,
oh yeah,
thick volume about like, here's Prey and here's the world of Prey, and it's a fucking like 2-inch thick book about like the world of Prey or whatever game. I just use that as an example. And I love all that stuff because I'm a big dork for that kind of geeky stuff. But like, it has its place. Right, exactly. But then the game feels obligated to like jam that everywhere and explain everything. Like, let me explain how the solar array works. And you're like, that's fine. You can just mention it, a weird piece of technology. Don't have to explain it to me. You know?
Oh, yeah, it's midichlorians.
Yeah. They feel obligated because they have it to share it with you because you might like it. And it takes away a lot of the mystery of a world where if they were like, well, here's what Mr. Saturn is. He's a race of this thing and he came from this planet at this time. And you're like, well, all the mystery and joy is kind of sucked out of it by these facts, you know?
Exactly. And I have no idea. Like, I have no desire to learn sometimes. It's like, if this character says he's my friend and he acts in a way that's good, I just want to be that guy's friend. And that's it.
Yeah.
I don't need to know like, oh, here's this tragic backstory. Here's this. And do you remember, like, I don't know when this was, but I feel like there was like 2 or 3 years where at the end of every game you died. Like the main character died.
Call of Duty.
Yeah.
I know that there was, I don't want to spoil all these games.
Spoiler alert, turn off the podcast now. Okay.
Yeah.
That's safe. Go for it.
But it got to this point where I was playing a game and I was anticipating that there's going to be a twist and I'm going to die.
BioShock Infinite did it for sure.
Yeah. And there was
Spec Ops
did it.
Yeah. Yep.
And like, obviously some of these did it to great effect, like, Red Dead, of course.
Yeah.
And it's not that like, oh, this is always a bad choice, but I feel like the industry moves in that way of, okay, now it's shocking to kill off the main character. And it's that zeitgeisty thing where everyone's going, okay, we're going to do it now.
Yeah.
And I would love to have games that don't need that big twist or don't need that huge climactic moment. Like it's good enough to have a small story, as long as that story feels important to the player. It doesn't have to be huge.
It feels like a lot of developers or writers care more about like plot logic and making that the prime factor instead of the emotional logic between characters. And
oh my god, totally.
Developing them more, because that's what the player will be engaged with more than the plot, no matter what.
And I totally fell for this when I was working. So I was the co-creator of Tales from the Borderlands, and I was a big Borderlands lore nerd. Like, I was the guy, people are like, what about this story thing? I'm like, well, you can't do that because this company didn't exist at that point. The timeline, you have to do it, blah, blah, blah. Like, I was that guy. So my first shot at a story was so dense in, like, Borderlands lore nerdery. Like, if you weren't a Borderlands fan, you'd have no frigging clue what was going on. And I was like, no, it's great. And, like, there'll be this twist, and like, we'll save this cool moment for, like, this part in the story. And, like, I held all the cards really close to my chest as far as, like, the twists and, like, the reveals and the cool moments. And through certain circumstances, they were just like, we're just going to do this. We're just going to show people. Like, just show them the cool stuff. Like, why are you holding it to your chest? And I realized, like, I thought the twist was cool because it made me feel like a smart writer and like a smart designer. Because like, oh, they're going to realize that this was this thing all along and be like, whoa, you blew my mind. But like, that's just not how people play games. Like, they're just going to be like, oh, okay, that makes sense. So I was
cool
getting
for like a moment.
Yeah, yeah. But like, I was willing to like shoot the story in the knees to get this thing to match up in a way that I thought was so clever. And it was just clever for myself. And I definitely learned that, like, and I see it now that I've gone through it and made that mistake and come out the other side. I see it all the time in games where it's like, you just put this in because it seemed clever. And it was way more important to you to get this like plot thing in than just, and it blew the story up. Like, it made the story scale up by degrees. So just letting the story be like using that as a backdrop and letting the story be about the characters' interactions with each other is scary, because it's not like that's easy. That's the easy stuff. It seems like from like the design and like writing standpoint, when you start thinking, when you're just like on the whiteboard with like post-it notes, you're like, that's the easy stuff. We'll figure that out later. What happens in like the act three turn or whatever? And so I totally admit like getting bogged down in that and making a bunch of mistakes and making a really not good story just so that they'd be reveals. And it's so easy to do. And yeah, like you said earlier, like there's a zeitgeist of like, well, oh man, how unusual would it be if your character died? Like, people would never expect that. And everyone just kind of thought that at the same, like, they had a shared dream, I guess. And they all thought it at the same time. And a lot of them just did it for the shock value and not because it meant anything. Like, it wasn't earned. So
yeah,
it just happened. Yeah. Like, it just happens. And you're like, oh, okay, I guess I'm dead. But for the stories that did it well, I was like, yeah, that is the completely, perfectly normal and understandable end to this character's story. So it just became a they're doing it, we need to do it too thing.
Which is tough to avoid sometimes.
Yeah.
Because I think there's also outside pressure to do that same thing. where people say like, okay, well, it's got to ramp up here and here, save this for a big reveal here. And it's not necessarily true to the story that you're telling.
It's maybe people who are telling you that who are not experienced with story. And
no,
are,
but they need to have, they need to have those moments. I mean, there's times when you get an email, you know, on a project and it's someone who goes like, hey, I saw this scene from this movie. It would be really cool if we could just put this in.
Or they read Save the Cat or Story. And
oh, yeah. And you go like,
that's not how it works, man.
Yeah.
Oh, I think we could do a whole podcast about those things.
Oh, for sure.
We're just like following a formula.
Yeah.
Like it has to, you got to have the act two turn. You got to have the like, et cetera. Like all the stuff they just read in a book or like learned in class or like absorbed from talking to other smart writers.
Yeah.
And like applying it without thinking like about this, like the specifics of why they're doing it. Yeah.
It's the hero's journey.
Oh, fuck.
Also, before I forget, when we were talking about Earthbound and how crazy that story is, I am excited about Mario Odyssey and how it appears like they're not going to explain anything about them, about New Donk City, and how there are humans in addition to Mario.
That are completely different, like, physicality than Mario.
Yeah.
Yes, which opens up way more questions. And there's a bit, I think they're asking, like, could Mario, as a T-Rex, ride Yoshi?
Yeah.
And my favorite thing is that the answer given was, that would be very difficult for Yoshi. Please don't do that. And I thought, like, that's beautiful. That's the way that we should be responding to those questions. It's like, yeah, that's not out of the realm of possibility. We haven't written a way out of this or into this. It's just like, hey, Yoshi's your buddy. maybe don't be a T-Rex and ride on his back.
Yeah.
I love the implication and like the like Twitter memes that are just like, has Mario just been a sentient hat the entire time?
Yeah.
Like, has he just like this whole time, like, who is Mario? Is it the man or is it the
mustache?
Yeah, like he's just been like stuck on this poor like it's a symbiotic relationship with this poor plumber like for like decades now. And I was talking to somebody the other day, can't remember who it was, and they were just like talking about how it just like devolved into like a Twin Peaks conversation, and how like Mario 3 was just like Twin Peaks because like at the beginning of that game, the first thing you see is a red curtain and a black and white floor, and it just turned into this hilarious conversation about like the world of Mario being way darker secretly than it actually appears at first blush, because now you're just like possessing human beings with a hat.
You're not possessing them, you're capturing them.
That's not any better. That's no
yeah
better.
Wait, like
actually it's worse.
And has this all, I don't know the lore, has this always been Cappy?
I don't know,
no one knows, but like that's the thing.
It's yeah, it's amazing. I want to go back to like one of my favorite Mario games is Super Mario RPG.
Oh yeah, man.
And that I would like to go back and consider in light of this Cappy information. Because essentially, Geno was a Cappy.
Yeah.
Because he was a star who invaded a doll.
Wow.
And he had his own thing. And then at the end of it, he goes back to being a doll. So I would like to posit that Cappy is actually from Star Road.
I love that there's like a larger like Legend of Zelda-esque lore chain that just happens between like all the Mario games where like, well, actually Mario 2 comes before Mario 1, really. And like, it's like this like long like timeline that actually exists between every single game, because that would be incredible.
Oh yeah. It has to be something. It's like the Donkey Kong games, right? Donkey Kong Country, because Cranky Kong is
the original,
like,
Donkey Kong.
Original Donkey Kong.
And Donkey Kong Jr. is Donkey Kong's grandchild.
Or like Cranky Kong was the original Donkey Kong, or
yeah,
something like that,
yeah,
right? Like,
yeah. And then I think Wrinkly Kong died.
Oh, God.
Man.
Yeah.
Imagination's coming back, you guys, and Nintendo's doing it.
It's dark. It's a dark
it
world,
is,
apparently.
Though. Like, Nintendo's always been very good at that. I read an article the other day that was about ARMS. And
yeah,
it was, because I think the premise for that is like one day a bunch of people woke up and some of them had crazy arms, and then they went and decided like, hey, we've got crazy arms now, let's fight with those arms. And there were a couple pieces of writing about how like, well, we need more lore and hopefully Nintendo will expand on this. And I'm like, I hope they don't. Because that's all the lore you need sometimes.
Or they answer one question and then ask another.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, I agree. It's just, here's what it is.
Yeah, you're in or you're out.
I'm going to switch tracks for a little bit. And Harrison.
Mm.
So having gone from Telltale to Hangar 13, was there anything surprising you learned in terms of how you expected to tell a story in an open world game?
Well, yes. Open world games are very tough to tell a story in, surprise. Because you give so much control up to the player, and they sort of decide at what pace they want to engage with it, because you know, you give them a cutscene that sort of gives them their motivation, and then say, okay, here's a sandbox, just go like knock over the castles, and once you've done enough of that, you'll get to the next story point. But also there's a bunch of shiny stuff you can collect, and you can go on like races and do all this other like side stuff, that you can go collect costumes and, you know, have fun in this crazy world where you just give you a bunch of toys to play with. And it just makes it like the pacing of all your motivations really weird. Like, are you in a revenge story, or are you going around like collecting pickups and like Playboy magazines and like shiny objects and like getting outfits and stuff? So like consolidating all of that into a cohesive story that just kind of ignores that stuff, it was really, I mean, I wasn't a writer on the project, but I can imagine it was really difficult, because you might go 5-6 hours before you get another piece of actual like plot, because you're just engaging in content slowly and just consuming it as slowly as you can, and getting like being a completionist and getting every single little piece of the game you can before you move on to the next big story beat. Whereas in a game like Uncharted, or like a really linear game, you can basically, other than skill checks and like combat being too difficult, you can basically say this game will be done in 10 hours. Like, there's no way a player's gonna be playing this game for more than 10 hours. But with Mafia, you can play the game for 40 hours, 45, 50, you know, who knows? So yeah, the telling a story the Telltale way, which is very, you know, other than dialogue choices, pretty linear. It was actually a mark of success during a playtest that people would play it and finish it within a certain time period of each other, because it meant that the puzzles weren't stumping one type of person over anyone else. The combat wasn't too hard. Like, you were able to finish the episode in 2 hours or 2.5 hours, and everyone finished it within like 15 minutes of each other. That would be like a thumbs up. And then I moved to Hangar, where it's just like, I don't know, you can just kind of do it in your own way, and you can't tell the player to speed up. Like, you can't, you know, stop the player. If two people are talking, one of the pieces of content I worked on was for DLC 2, and you are going through this like bunker, and the bad guy is doing like a PA, like Bioshock-esque, like taunting you over the PA thing. And obviously those would be set in places where there weren't combat, but if the players wanted to like bull rush into the next room and like kick all the doors open and like start combat, you can't stop them. So, you know, that's up to the player. If they don't care about the story, they're just going to kind of do that, and that's fully fine. But having like a bunch of characters like react to, oh man, that guy said some nasty shit about you over the PA. How do you feel about that? Let's have a two-line exchange about that. If they want to listen to that, they will, but you can't force them to. So a lot of that story is like you offer it on a plate. You're like, please enjoy the story. And they will either take it or they won't. And it's completely optional to them. So it makes it a lot more difficult to sort of force that emotional engagement that you might want.
And I know, so like pacing and maintaining narrative tension are like two of the big problems, but are there any other big open world design problems that you think haven't been solved still?
I think that, and I touched on it a bit earlier, and I honestly don't know if this is a open world problem or just a video game problem, but man, keeping the motivation of the player and the character in sync all the time is so difficult. And it's one of the things I talk about a lot when I do talks about like emotional engagement and like quote unquote feeling in game design, because like you want your player and your character to have the same feeling and the same motivations as often as possible, so you want to do what the game is asking you to do. But a lot of times, like Mafia 3 is a revenge story, and if you don't care about the revenge story, like you don't care about any of it. And so your motivation might just be to go collect all the stuff, and your character is like there being like, no, I want to get revenge for my fallen comrades and my family that got murdered. And you're like, nah, that's cool. I want to do some races though. And like,
yeah, that's
you just
very
don't,
weird and difficult.
It's
to
super
manage.
Hard. Yeah, I mean, but yeah. Even like in Uncharted, like. And this has been brought up many times. This is not a new concept, but like Nathan Drake's a mass murderer, right? The most like charming, charismatic mass murderer ever. And him in a cutscene and you playing him in a gameplay like a gunfight are two different Nathan Drakes. So
wildly
like getting
different.
Yeah, so getting the player like on board with both Nathan Drakes and sort of like like waving your hands in front of the player's face and be like, don't even pay attention to that. Like, it's the same Nathan Drake. Seriously, they can just like throw a smoke bomb down and just hope they don't notice that it's very different. It's super hard.
Yeah, Uncharted 2, I think at the end of the game when he's facing off against Lazarevich, the guy says to him, like, how many men have you killed just today?
Right.
And Drake's answer is like, anyway.
Yeah, like, let's
like,
just
they don't
shine
really,
a light on that, well. Dude.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very odd. And again, I don't think this is necessarily an open world problem, but it's exacerbated in an open world game where you're not forcing the player to go through the content in a way that would sort of be commensurate with the player's motivation, or like the character's motivation. So, you know, if Lincoln, and luckily Lincoln Clay as a character is very driven to do the thing he wants to do. So at no point is he ever wildly different from the cutscene version of him, because he is just a criminal who wants to murder every other criminal that ever wronged him out of a sense of like vengeance. And that's literally the thing that you do. So that kind of matches pretty easily. But then there is this, okay, I'm going to do some races and do some other stuff that Lincoln would never do. Like, he would never do those things. And even, like, getting the player on board with, like, taking down criminal rackets and districts one by one to, like, undercut the top guy is tough to sell, because that's the open world part of the game. And, in fact, there's a dialogue between your CIA handler and your main character, Lincoln, who's like, why don't you literally just put on some grease paint, put on a night vision goggles, and just like find him in his house and murder him. Like, you're a Vietnam like spec ops dude. Like, you could just kill him right now. And Lincoln has to make an excuse about, no, I got to cut his legs off from under him and make him feel pain and see all his things go up in smoke. And that's, you know, that makes sense. And it actually is sort of believable in the game. But like, if this was a dude who knew how to kill a guy, he would just do that, you know, and then there'd be no open world game. So like, trying to like make it feel like the open world game has to exist for the story to work is really hard.
I wonder, like, because a lot of the time you do get lampshading like that, right? Where someone has to bring up the point in order to acknowledge, like, oh, we know that this is weird. And so you have to kind of put a line in or something about Nathan Drake killing everybody. Yeah. And I wonder, like, is that for the audience, really? Or is that for the writers?
It's so we feel better about it, right?
Yeah, because it feels a lot of the time like they're just going, like, listen, guys, we understand that this is an issue. We're just going to let you, like, we're on the same side as you here, but we got to do it because it's a game.
Right.
And I wonder if that like needs to be done all the time, or if we're doing it because we're all very insecure.
I know for Uncharted 2, Amy Hennig did an interview where she said that she deliberately did the lampshading for the players, just so they know, like, hey, we know.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah. And they have I think they have an award for it in
Uncharted 4 has an achievement for it.
Yeah, oh, little narrative dissonance.
It's insane.
You kill like 150 or 200 people, and they give you a
that's incredible. Dissonance that, I love that.
Clint I laugh at
hate it. That. As the guy who came up with the term and now regrets it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that a lot of it also comes down to just like plausible deniability. We can be like, look, we talked about it. Like, there's an excuse, and there's an in-world reason why you can't just go kill that guy. So if anyone like brings it up on a forum somewhere, you at least have some sort of like
you can refer back to that.
Yeah, you have ammo to be like, but in the world of Mafia 3, like, here's the reason he didn't do that. So you can't just be like, oh, whoops, we screwed that up, huh?
Yeah.
You at least have a little bit of like defense, which is flimsy, but you have something. Yeah.
I think it's also tied to the fact that like we make games way too often about killing, death, murder, and things that in our own lives are hugely important and hugely motivational. And therefore, everything that isn't that feels out of place. Whereas if you had a game, I think, where you were saying, like, this open world game is about helping people, it's about collaborating with people, it's about interacting with people, engaging with them, or solving mysteries or something, you have a little bit more room to move around and make those side quests feel like something that the character might have time to do. Because yeah, a lot of the time it's like, you know, my entire family is dead, but also my neighbor wants me to collect 10 feathers.
Right.
And
so I can make a wallet.
Yeah, exactly, right? It's like, I'm going to kill a bunch of whatever animals are in Far Cry to kill. Like, I'm going to kill a bunch of them to make this. And then maybe in a bit, I'm going to liberate the country.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's anything we can necessarily do, because part of the mandate is like, make sure it lasts 100 hours. But I would prefer if, you know, we could explore an open world game that didn't have that sense of life or death urgency, but still had an engaging quality to it. And I don't know what that game would look like.
But definitely comes down to...
I'd want to see that.
No, I agree. I mean, we had this problem on Mafia 3 too, where like the only verbs you had were like stalk and kill. So there weren't like, and we kind of knew that, we're just like, well, this is the game we're making, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But we all were like, man, if we had other verbs, like you would have other ways to express yourself in the game. Dialogue is so scary. Whenever you bring up dialogue to any AAA people, like, no way, nope, nope, nope. Cause they imagine to be like Telltale level of like Branch, like, no, just have like a button where you can say hi to someone. And they're like, cool. What's up, man? And you can high five them. And like, you can have like a real moment with a person. Like, you're in New Orleans and you want to like listen to a jazz musician and flip him a coin into his like hat. Like that all seems pretty easy to do, where you can just relate to human beings in a way that is not murderous. And once you do that, it allows designers to be like, oh man, well now that we have this sort of quote unquote dialogue system, I can add a beat where you talk to your roadie and he tells you a story and you can be like, yeah, man, I hear you, because let me tell you about something in my life. And
yeah, that'd be amazing.
But it's so terrifying to add that kind of thing, because the value add and a lot of folks' heads in the AAA space is like, that's not worth it. We need to really hone in on like the feeling, making the combat feel rad, which is definitely important, but the fear of allowing the player other ways to encounter that game, like,
yeah,
not giving you a camera so you can walk around, just take cool pictures of the video game that we built for you. You know what I mean? Just like obvious things, and letting you put filters on your selfies and like post, like the fact that you can in Firewatch get those pictures printed and sent to you is phenomenal. So like that's, I mean, you know, that's not everyone can afford to do that, but like just allowing you to engage in the with the world in a completely optional way that isn't just killing or like trying to stalk and hide bodies, and just talk to people, would just add so much for the, like, so many tools for the game designer to actually use to build cool experiences that aren't murder.
One of my favorite things was in Assassin's Creed 3, you could pet the animals.
Oh my God.
That was like, after parkour, that was the Assassin's Creed franchise's biggest innovation to me. Like, yep. It was, now I see a cat and I can crouch down and pet that cat.
And then they took it out.
Yep. And I said, I'm not responsible for that.
I saw a good tweet that was like, don't put animals in your game if you can't pet them.
Yeah. I fully agree. Because I want to, and like sometimes, even in Night in the Woods, like you mentioned, you see like a little non-human, like a non-anthropomorphized cat that walks by. And occasionally it makes a little sound and I'm like, oh, this is great.
Yeah.
Or in Breath of the Wild, you can't pet the dogs.
Oh my God, it makes me so mad. Run around and like chase their tail, and they can play fetch with you and stuff. You can throw like a branch to them if they're friendly enough with you, and they'll like go get it. And they can like dig up stuff out of the ground and stuff, but you can't, like, they put in all this dog related stuff, but not petting. It's ridiculous.
Let me reward him.
Yeah.
And like, for how amazing the levels are designed, like in Assassin's Creed, like all the cities, how good they look, I would love to have a way to like explore and learn about that city that's not going into the menus, like reading the little journal entries about like, here's what happened this day and this year.
Right.
Same. And I wrote a lot of them. Like,
I would just not.
I miss, more than anything, Assassin's Creed 2, and just having it like, oh, here's an interesting fact, and you can. I felt like I was engaging with the city in Assassin's Creed 2, and I guess in Brotherhood as well. And then later on, it was like, hey, everybody, we know you don't want to learn about boring history, so we're just gonna tuck it away back here.
I would totally do like a walking tour, like audio tour of Assassin's Creed.
For
levels.
Sure, and that's what Sean used to be in the game. Like the Sean character, who kind of, I used to love that stuff, and it's gone, and I'm really sad about it.
This reminds me of Red Dead, when like it's a really simple interaction that doesn't really do much, but you being able to tip your hat to people,
yes,
was insane to me. So great, and
this is some good
so
games.
What verbs would like both of you want to see used more in games these days besides petting and petting dogs and petting everything?
Oh, man, that's
I think
tough
I
one.
Overall want more ability to ask for help.
Because
a lot of the time I'll be in a situation where I'll see like a bunch of NPCs milling about in a city. And even if it's like we'll go back to Uncharted, you know, there's something that I'm doing that's not necessarily illegal. I just have to find this stand. I wish that I could just go and go like, hey, I need a little bit of assistance. or I want to be able to interact with people and say, like, how's your day going? And just hear something back. Or say, hey, I'm looking for this stall, and have someone go, hey, it's over there. Like, one of the,
that'd be great.
I really liked in L.A. Noir when you're in the car and you can choose not to drive.
Yeah.
Or you can choose to drive and get directions from your friend. He'll say, oh, yeah, turn left up here. And that felt so natural and created a bond that was so easy to do. It's just a GPS. But it gave me a lot.
Because they would have conversations too. Then he would stop his conversation, tell you the direction, then keep going with his conversation.
Yeah, I loved it. And I think just having little interactions, if someone opens a door for me, if someone, you know, if someone has dropped something and I can pick it up for them. And just small things that would make me feel like I wasn't the only interesting character in this world.
You're not the only character that's doing something.
Yeah, like sometimes I'm afraid of flying. And sometimes I look around when I'm on a plane and I go, like, I think we'll probably be okay because there's a lot of people here who look more interesting than me. And they probably have, like, I'm probably an NPC here and they're going to be okay.
Yeah.
And
player character's controlling the plane right now.
Yeah, exactly. And there's too many games where the crowd is just like a bunch of very boring people. And I think, you know, in terms of, I always think back to Assassin's Creed, but like your player character is so over-designed that everyone else around you looks boring. And I'd like to be able to feel like I'm part of this city and part of the society and like I can't just accidentally kill them because they get in my way.
Yeah. I would love to see, like, my ideal Assassin's Creed game, I would love to see just other assassins working on their own assignments, like running around the city doing stuff. Like,
totally.
Even it'll never affect me, but like I just want to see them running around and like talking to people. That would help so much with that world, I think.
For sure, because like sometimes I'll be walking down the street and a cat will walk like past me, and I'll think, oh, I wonder what he's up to.
Right.
And I would love to have that feeling in a game.
Yeah, it's the feeling of like, the game has to, like, the world has to revolve around you is definitely a toxic one. And I push back on it as often as I can. But, like, because AAA games are such, like, power fantasies in a lot of ways that aren't emotionally deep, they want you to feel special. They want you to feel like you're Neo and everyone's, like, looking to you going, what do you think we should do? Like, because it's just there to make you feel powerful. And that's emotionally boring in a lot of ways. So, like, having other people who are just as interesting and important as you, who are like, I hear you. I don't agree. I think we should do it this way. Like, as much as I enjoy power fantasy, it still just makes it more realistic and it makes me emotionally bond to those characters more, or we can have an earnest discussion about a thing I think we should do. And Walking Dead does this pretty well, early Walking Dead stuff.
I was going to mention, actually, Walking Dead as an example of, like, a time when you don't necessarily feel like the most important person there. You certainly don't. Like, you know you're not.
Yeah, and that was intentional.
And as a result, you're motivated to help other people.
Exactly, because without them, your existence and the game's continuation are more tenuous. So, that was definitely intentional, because getting to do whatever you want felt antithetical to what that world was about, which is just like you react. It's all you get to do is react to things happening to you, and you can react however you want, but you are rarely like the one who's like, let's just drive to New York, because it's just not the reality of that world. It was an intentional design choice, and it was scary to be like, and we had a lot of like internal like heated debates about like, is this the right way to go? Because the player, why would you want to play a character that isn't all powerful and gets to do what you want? Like, why would you play a game that doesn't let you do what you want to do? And it just came down to like, well, let's make sure that the player we are giving the player what they want to do, but only giving them a range of actions that makes sense to the characters. So like Lee's never going to be like, screw you, Clementine, I'm out of here, and jump in a Camaro and like peel out. Cause it's just, that character would never do that. So like being bound to the motivations of the character allowed us to say like, listen, Lee's not going to punch a dude in the face, be like, screw you guys, I'm in charge, because that's just not what he would do. So when someone says, hey, Lee, what do you think we should do? And you tell them, and they're like, eh, I don't know, man, I don't know about that. Like, it feels real, it feels earned, and you don't feel like the game isn't giving you what you want.
Yeah, I think we need to be a little better about having more characters like that, and who are not, and whose lack of power isn't necessarily terrifying either.
Right.
Like, you know, you take an Outlast or an Outlast 2, which, like, great, but I'm so scared all the time.
Yeah.
And I was playing Dishonored 2 the other day and trying to, like, ghost through certain levels. And I realized, like, this is exactly the same as what I'm doing in Outlast. Only in one, the story has made me feel that I'm doing this for the safety of others, and in Outlast, I'm doing it for the safety of myself. But all I am doing is making sure that no one sees me and hiding behind tables.
Yeah.
And I would like to see it framed, I guess, more frequently that if you have that much power, oh no, I'm going to say the thing, you have to take certain responsibilities on. I'm not going to fully do it.
Yeah, that's true.
But yeah, and that's what I do like about the Dishonored feeling is that you understand that you are a killer, but unless you play like that, you're trying to keep the world quiet and people safe. And that's why you hide.
Mm.
So I guess I just, in worlds in general, I would just like to have more opportunity to treat people with general kindness or to ask people for help.
And respect.
Yeah, and have a sense that, like, the interesting people exist all around me and it's up to me to make my relationships with them.
Are there any AAA games that have done that recently?
Not that I can think of besides stories. I mean, if you go back to something that like the Naughty Dog makes, you take like an Uncharted, all the characters that you interact with are empathetic because they're all important. There's not a lot of crowds and there's not a lot of NPCs there.
Yeah.
It's not AAA necessarily, but Life is Strange does a good job of, like, Chloe is a way more interesting character than you. And you go through that world, you know, in a lot of ways needing her, and you're using your powers to help her and to solve her mysteries. And it doesn't feel weird. It just feels like this is a person that I want to invest in. And I want more of that.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Related to our imagination discussion earlier and a bit to your work at Telltale, Harrison, for both of you, when you're making an important choice in a game, how explicit do you want the choice and outcome to be? And how much should be left to your imagination? And like for listeners, as an example, for like an explicit choice would be something like Telltale's games where you have a prompt to choose between killing someone and setting them free. The choice and outcome are clear. And the opposite end of that would be something like near the end of Spec Ops when civilians have surrounded you and are throwing rocks and it's clear you need to get out of there, but no prompts show up explaining what you can or should do. And the obvious choice is to shoot them because that's what you've been doing the entire game. It feels like it's the only thing you can do. But the other possible action is actually just to shoot in the air and scare people away and not kill anyone. So, yeah, what do each of you gravitate towards more?
I think both can be really powerful ways to express choice. I think what it really comes down to is making sure the player is fully aware of the possibility space. In the Spec Ops example, if you had never shot a gun in the air and had anyone react to it, like, the player doesn't know that's an option. So, like, you need to at least set the table for them and let them know that there are things you can do. Like, if you previously have never told them a specific mechanic or a specific thing will happen, then they're not going to know that's a thing. I personally was really against the Clementine will remember that prompts because I thought it was more interesting if the player didn't know. And I think that I was wrong in that. I still think it's, you know, we allow people to turn them off, I think. But, like, I think that it's really important to let the player, because you go into a game having no expectations about what the borders of that game world are. So if you go into a game and you're playing a dialogue game, you're making choices or whatever, you're not expecting those choices to be remembered by any of the characters and be recalled, because up until that point, a game hasn't proven to you that that's what they're doing, that other games haven't done that. Why would this game just, why would you just assume the game is doing that? So once Clementine will remember that pops up, you're like, oh shit, okay, this game's going to be recording my choices. Now I know that that's within the possibility space. So the thing that we really tried to focus on in the Telltale version is if you see a guy and he's locked up and you can free him or not free him, when you push the button that says free him, you always get what you want. You get to free that person. We never, like, fake you out and say, oh, well, you couldn't because it's locked. But what we try and do is make sure that the consequence is unknown. So in that timer, in that space when the timer is kind of ticking down and you can choose, like, well, if I free this guy, he might brain me and take my stuff, or, like, he might yell, or he might run away, or he might be my friend. I don't know. That's kind of what I alluded to earlier, like, that imagination space. So all of those things are real in that why is that timer ticks down. And then you pick your choice and you get what you want. But the consequence of those actions could be anything. So I think that they're both, I wouldn't say one is more powerful or correct over the other. I think as long as the player knows the possibility space exists and sort of explaining what that is to the player, even if you're not giving them specific prompts in the moment, but you're like, I know I have a gun, I know I can shoot it, I know I can kill NPCs because I've done that. So that is within possibility space. Then you're giving the player options. Otherwise, they don't know what the options are. And that can be really frustrating where you're like, why couldn't I shoot in the air? Like, if they didn't have that option, like I tried shooting in the air and it didn't work. Why didn't it? Because you didn't clearly say that's outside the possibility space. It's just not a thing we support in this game. So being very careful about messaging that to the player is more important, I think, than like explicitly telling the player this is a specific choice in the moment.
It's also tough when you have a choice like that where you say, like, you're trying to make kind of a statement here by saying, well, why did you kill those people?
Right.
Why didn't you just fire in the air? And the player there is not going to reflect on, oh, I wonder why I did kill those people. Because to them, it's like, well, because you set up a game for me where I had to kill everybody.
Yeah.
And I think that in some cases, yeah, unless you prepare them for that in some way, it can result in kind of a feeling of like, oh, that's kind of being smug at the player's interaction with that world. Because it's not that they chose to kill people, it's that they just chose to play this game.
Right, exactly. Well, they didn't know they were making the wrong choice because they didn't know it was a choice.
Exactly. And like, it ends up just more being kind of an Easter egg than like a conscious decision to interact with people in this way. And I think I also really appreciate that if you give a prompt, you can perform that prompt, because one of my least favorite things is when it says open door and it's like, oh, door's locked. Like, in all games I will try to open this door, it's like, oh no, you just can't. And like, just don't put open door then. Like, go ahead, it's fine, I don't need to know, just put locked on it, I'm good.
That would solve so many problems.
It really would.
Doors are a nightmare. Doors are like that. Like, I think Liz England wrote a really good article, I think on Kotaku, about like how awful doors are. Like, they're so complicated. They seem so easy in real life, but they're so complicated in a video game. It's a really good article.
Probably be our last question, but what tools for both of you do you think in the storytelling toolbox do you feel that are overutilized or underutilized?
I think Harrison said the twist, and I really agree with that.
Yeah.
I think withholding information just to have a twist gets used a lot. And I think that it would be nicer to have a better relationship with the audience in the story and kind of like take them through something that's a little more honest. Which isn't to say that twists are always bad.
No.
Like, sometimes you have an amazing twist, you're like, this is literally a game changer. But I think I don't want to always insist that we go to that well, or we always have this one mystery or this one betrayal. And sometimes just say, like, we're going to commit to this story and we're going to take you on this journey.
Yeah, I agree.
Do you think there's anything that's not used enough these days, or not used that you wish you saw more of?
I think Tom Francis, who made Gunpoint, wrote a really good article on this too. So you can have another article you can write about the intro, the difference between the intro to Prey and the intro to Deus Ex: Mankind Divided, where the difference between like unknown information and like a mystery to solve is very different. Where in Prey, that game begins and you do a bunch of tests and then like a crazy thing happens and you wake up and it's the same day again. You feel like you're looping and you're doing the same day over and over again. And it's like, why is this happening? That's I want to find that out. That's a really interesting question. Whereas in Deus Ex Mankind Divided, it's like a bunch of terrorists in gold masks show up and like crash your like big drug deal. And now you have to figure out who they are. And it's like, I don't care because they're just bad guys. Who gives a shit? And that's just very different. So understanding the difference between like what the player, like what's interesting to the player and not to the writer, to like figure out like what this is, an interesting mystery. I want to understand like my place in the world. I want to understand like the rules of the world and why things are the way they are, and get to know the characters in it. And there's some odd thing that I don't understand, but it's not like a twist. It's just like, well, unfortunately in Prey, it is kind of a twist, but like there is a mystery to solve and then you can just solve that mystery and feel rewarded for solving. It doesn't have to be a big twist. And I feel like we've been chasing the, would you kindly moment ever since it happened. And speaking of like, you know, what you said, Kim, of like, it's a game changer. Like the Atlas thing, it was totally a game changer, but I honestly can't remember a game having such a like pivot before that. Like Deus Ex, the original Deus Ex had the like, oh, you're the government's actually pretty shitty, you shouldn't work for them, like you were told these people were terrorists, but they're actually like the, maybe the good guys. And you kind of like change loyalty slowly as this becomes more apparent. It's not like twist, they're evil. Like it just kind of happens naturally over the course of, like, you just gain suspicion over the course of that game because it's a conspiracy theory game. So it was never like a pivot. Right. But ever since Would You Kindly, it's been like, we got to blow their minds with a crazy twist. And now
it's just so amazing. Because they didn't stick that landing, and that's something that they acknowledged, that they did such an amazing job, and then they felt they still had to do more.
Right, and then they had a boss fight where you beat him up instead of just letting you leave or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't think
they knew what they had.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that it was like, this is going to be rad, but now it's like, we come to expect those twists. Like every game I go into, like I went into Prey being like, all right, here's my theory about what the twist is going to be.
Oh, for sure.
And so, you know, we go in cynical, and it's made us cynical. So I think that just giving you a cool mystery and you solve it and you're like, oh, that's cool. Like, that was interesting. And not being like a, oh, shoot, like big twist pivot either during the credits or after the credits or, you know, in the final act of the game that recontextualizes everything you've done. And
yeah, sometimes I'm good with just like winning.
Right.
I'm good with just getting through the story and finding the end. It doesn't have to have that like huge moment every single time.
No.
It's like when everything's a twist, nothing's a twist.
Yeah, totally. Because then you just look for it, right? And then it's not like you can't just enjoy the story because you're just cynical and you're like picking at the edges. Like, okay, is this it? Is this the twist? Is this this part of it? Should I be looking at this? Is this a clue that I should have figured out later, like earlier?
And yeah, like you just when can't is enjoy this it. Friend going to betray me?
Right, exactly.
What am I going to betray? Radio? Oh, for sure. You don't trust anyone you don't see nowadays.
Yeah.
I also, the last thing, or at least the last thing for me, I want everything to not, I don't want every story to be about the end of the world. Yes. If I don't succeed, I don't need everything in the world to end. And that was, even in The Last of Us, it wasn't necessary for me necessarily to know, it wasn't important for me to know that she could save everyone in the world.
Yeah.
I just wanted to get her there. And obviously that's a fantastically written game, but it can be small, and I'd like to see more small stories. And you know, like The Walking Dead, that's a great example of it, is that we can't solve this big problem, which is that zombies are real, but we can solve this. And I think more AAA experiences for me could rely on that. And it also doesn't have to be like, oh, my whole family's dead, or like I have to avenge someone. Give me a motivation that I care about, and it can just be about that, and I'm okay.
Yes.
But I feel like the same way that I remember as a kid realizing that like almost every Disney movie ends with like that red sky and everything's falling apart and the whole world seems dark. And I don't always need it to go that way. Because it's just like the twist, when everything's about the end of the world, it doesn't feel as relatable.
That's a really good point. Go ahead.
No. I was going to make a brief thing saying that the games industry should not be taking its cues as much, make cues from the industry as it wants to, but it should make an exception in the case of everyone involved in stories and games should watch Magic Mike XXL, because that's a movie where ostensibly it's about a bunch of male strippers. They're going to a convention in Florida for a competition, but it's not about them trying to win it. They don't really care. They just want to have a good time with each other. And they just want to like make sure like they're good friends to each other. And the relationships in that movie are better written than most Hollywood blockbusters.
That's true. Totally true.
And that's everyone should watch that.
It's funny that you say that, Kim, because I definitely had that exact conversation with, I can't remember who, but like many years ago about like, I can't identify with what it's like for the world to end, right? Like that's not a thing that we can like map our emotions onto. So people are like freaking out in a bunker and like you're trying to understand that as like their motivation. It's like, don't know what that is. So I mean, I can imagine it's bad, and I would imagine that they want to stop the world from ending. But I know what it's like to lose a loved one. I know what it's like to be rejected by someone you love. I know what it's like to disappoint someone you care about. I like all the things that happen in daily and in small stories, I can identify with. Because like, hell yeah, that happened to me. I know what that feels like. I get why the character is acting this way. So yeah, like the apocalypse, because it's like, oh, everything's got to be important and big and like bombastic and crazy. And that's okay for set dressing. But like this actual story itself is so, like, especially like Walking Dead, like it's so small. It's about a man protecting a girl.
Yeah, just make me deal with this.
Yeah, exactly. And like, you're not going to, like you said, you're not going to solve the zombie thing. It's just kind of the state of the world. It's never like, you know, we like in Last of Us, like we have the cure. It's just like, it's just the way the world is. There's no changing it. You just have to eke out an existence within this sort of space.
Yeah. And I just love to have things that like, where your biggest motivation is, what if I disappoint this person that I've been made to care about a lot?
Right.
It's still, you know, end of the like, world stakes, but it's just emotionally instead of
right.
that world.
Oh, yeah. On a daily basis, like, if you ask people what they're afraid of, it's like, I'm worried she's not going to text me back.
Yeah.
Yep.
And, like, how can I elicit that feeling in a game? Versus just like, oh, well, hey, Kim, yeah, my whole family got kidnapped. It's a whole thing. I got to collect these magazines today. It's really hard. And that's something more relatable.
Give me a game about trying to make rent. It'll probably be the most stressful game ever played.
Well, for sure. Everyone hates Tom Nook in Animal Crossing because he makes you pay for things. Like, that's enough of a villain sometimes. Yeah.
I could also take a break from Chosen One stories for a while, too.
Right.
For sure. Oh, and also, I want more. If I am the Chosen One, I'm going to need everyone to acknowledge it. I was very sad at the end of Skyrim. I think everyone was. I talk about this with colleagues a lot, is that when I saved the world, everyone's like, hey, get off of my land. I said, hey, I'm the chosen one.
Yeah, give like, me your land.
Hey, Dragonborn, yeah. Anyway, listen, I don't believe you that dragons are here. I saw you shot a dragon out of the sky, but you're probably just a rando. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, like we have to make a decision that either we are the chosen one and that matters, or we're just someone doing a cool thing and maybe the world doesn't know about us.
That's kind of what I liked about the Witcher games. And I to be fair, I'm not the hugest fan of those games for many reasons. But like the narrative is great because you're kind of distrusted. You're kind of like this witch hunter that no one really wants around, but you're there to do a job, like you're a mercenary. And so they like have this like grudging respect for you, but that's kind of as far as it goes. It's just like, oh, you're a witcher, huh? Well, you know, here's some things you can do for me. It's never like they're bowing down in reverence, and they're not, it's neither that nor is it, they just don't notice you when you enter the bar. Like, if you come into the tavern, everyone's heads turn and go, oh, shit, a witcher's here. And they kind of go back to what they're doing, which feels appropriate for who I am.
It's the perfect framing for a mission-based game.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly right.
And I think on that note, we're going to close things down. So, both of you, where can people find you on the internet?
Oh, I'm everywhere at Bagel of Death.
Good.
Awesome.
So, B-A-G-E-L of Death. That's Twitter, Instagram, even like everywhere. So just look for me there.
Do you want to pimp your podcast?
Oh, it's also, I mean, yeah, it's the sexiest podcast. We're on a little hiatus right now, but it's each week we rank the top three sexiest everything. So
that's amazing.
Whether that's roadside attractions, characters from Friends, or office supplies, we just talk about that with actually another, it's one of my co-writer on the book and also one of my co-writers at Ubisoft.
Awesome.
And so, yeah, check that out at Sexiest Pod.
Harrison.
I am on Twitter, Giles Pink, GILESPINK. Or you can just email me at harrisonpink@gmail.com.
And you're going to have a podcast out by the time this
podcast ends. Yeah, well, let's hope, right? It's called Storied. It's at StoriedCast on Twitter. It's basically a couple of friends and I talking about one particular type of media, such as a video game or a specific movie or a specific book even, and then sort of critically analyzing it and transforming it into another kind of media. So it's like half comedy podcast, half like critical analysis.
Such a good idea.
Yeah, thank you. So our first episode, we are taking Blizzard's Overwatch and turning it into a Saturday morning cartoon show. So by the time this comes out, hopefully it'll be out, and you can check it out at StoriedCast or on Twitter at StoriedCast.
Cool. You can find this podcast at ScriptLockCast on Twitter. Please leave a review on iTunes if you like this podcast. I'm serious. Leave a review. And that's it. Thank you, two, for both coming on.
All right. Thank you for having us.